Welcome to the American Family Physician Podcast for our first special bonus episode. In these bonus episodes, we will cover special topics or interviews with leaders in family medicine and other people making a difference for health in our country.
The opinions expressed in the podcast are our own and do not represent the opinions of the American Academy of Family Physicians, the editor of American Family Physician, or Banner Health. Do not use this podcast for medical advice. Instead, see your own family doctor for medical care.
We're on a mission, delivering the best from American Family Physician. On a mission, delivering the best from American Family Physician.
As you know by now, our podcast is hosted by residents and faculty, mostly residents of the University of Arizona College of Medicine Phoenix Family Medicine Residency. I'm Steve, and let's get right to the interview for this special bonus episode.
Sure. I'm Lloyd Michener. I'm a family doc, professor, and chair of community and family medicine at Duke. Been there 30-some years.
And also the, I don't know, founder, creator of the Practical Playbook?
like all good projects, it was a team. I was certainly a member of that team.
Very good. Tell us about the Practical Playbook.
Well, the Practical Playbook is a guide of very busy clinicians to help them figure out how they can practically help improve the health of their communities. It was written based on the experience we had here in Durham, working with our own community, but aid embedded by family docs and other clinicians all over the country.
And so what was the inspiration behind starting this?
It actually came from practice. I was a, I guess still am, a practicing family doc. Used to be very busy, mostly clinical, was the medical director for our residency practice, and took care of large numbers of folks, actually into three generations, which was really fun. But after doing that for about 10 and then even more, 15, 20 years, I realized that I was seeing the same problems over and over again, and things weren't getting worse. Obesity was getting worse, hypertension was getting worse, congestive heart failure, and that all the things that I was doing in the office mattered, but they really weren't stemming the tide. So the impetus of this was our experience reaching out into our community, making a host of errors and mistakes and picking ourselves up and trying again until we learned how to partner effectively with our community. And the outcomes of that were just stunning. It took a little practice, but as an example, within 2 years, we were able to reduce asthma admissions by almost 70%. Similarly with seniors in elderly high-rises, all of whom had docs, almost the same, just under 70% reduction in hospitalization rates. What we did in office mattered, but what we did in office matched with what we could do with the community mattered far more.
So you obviously had some impressive experience in your community. What made you decide that you wanted to take that national, or those were some things that you really wanted to share with people?
Sure. Two things. One is we're actually also one of the founders, original participants in the medical home movement in North Carolina, North Carolina Medicaid. So we were working with practices all over the state, but in particular in our network, because we oversee the Northern Piedmont Community Care, working with family practices all the way up in the Virginia border. And in fact, they were doing better at it than we would. So we realized that, well, we may have figured out some of this, folks could pick it up, adapt it, and do things that we hadn't even thought about. So that was one. The other one was that the Institute of Medicine came along with the support of Centers for Disease Control and HRSA and said they'd like to look at this idea of integrating primary care and public health nationally. And the work of that IOM committee showed that, well, what we thought what we'd done in Durham was neat. We were only one of many places that had rediscovered this old idea, but almost nobody knew about it. We were 100,000 points of light, but there was no central light, no central vision of how to do this. So that's how the IOM report really brought it together and said, we can do this collectively.
What will a family physician see when they go to your website? It's practicalplaybook.org, right?
It is. Hopefully some simple guidance about how to get started, how to learn about the problems that your community is concerned about, which are probably similar to what we worry about as family doctors, but they can be a little bit different because communities can view things through different lenses. They may see violence, for instance, as an issue, or food deserts. So they can learn about ways in partnering with your community and then about forming those sort of partnerships without going through 5 or 10 years of practical experience doing it the hard way.
So what would be three specific things that a family physician could do this year to engage in the community outside the office and improve population health? Where would you start?
That's a great question. One is just to learn about the problems that your community is concerned about. Again, most family docs have a pretty good sense of that, and we get pretty close, but we really hit it on the nose because we have a special position in our community. So learn what those are. Almost every county in the United States has done some sort of health assessment, and that's usually been led by the health department. So talk to your local health department if that's comfortable. Look it up online. Almost all these assessments are online. Or there's also a wonderful assembly of these reports at County Health Rankings, which is a website run by University of Wisconsin with Robert Johnson Foundation. And they'll give you a overview of the major health problems in any community, in any county in the United States. So learn about it. That'd be step one. The second one is actually go talk to people. Go listen to them. Don't go tell them what you're worried about. That was an early mistake that I made many times. But actually go listen to what issues they have and look for opportunities for partnership. So first learn, second listen. And the third is see what you can do in partnership with them to make a difference. It's a lot like taking care of patients, isn't it? First, you learn what their concerns are and you listen, and then you see what if you can form a partnership with them to try and make a difference. It's just like that with communities. You just have to know who to listen to.
Yeah, that's great. And then you also are the practical playbook is collecting stories also. So if a family physician has a particular success story or a partnership with the community, you'd like to hear about it.
We'd love to hear about it. We do collect the stories. You can send them in online. We do curate them. We look for particularly good examples. We work with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to actually look through those, pick out the ones that are most innovative or different or have the greatest success, and then we try to tease out what made that work. But some of those come right out of family practice residencies. In fact, one of our most famous stories is the San Diego Family Medicine Residency and one of their docs there who hooked up with the school teacher. And it was just the two of them partnering together that started a broad movement in San Diego that continues to this day. So it just start and then tell us about it, and we'll see if we can add it to the list of stories. We would love to work more with the Academy and the state chapters on doing similar models, and we're in that discussion with the Academy now. The playbook got turned into a book and came out just a month ago, 6 weeks ago. It was a request from Oxford University Press who said that some people would like to read this in a book form, so you can get it now. It was the press run for that was underwritten by the de Beaumont Foundation, who are our partners in this whole project. So you can get it from Amazon. And it's a streamlined version of the very large playbook website. It's been nice seeing all these. We've had over 160,000 hits to that site since we launched it a little bit over a year ago.
Wow, that's remarkable. So switching to your personal career, what were some key events that led you to where you are today, sort of a key moment or inflection point in your career?
There have been a couple. I would start personally. I was raised by a Quaker social activist parents who were active in the civil rights movement. So I come by this somewhat naturally. But I've also been impressed how many activists there are in family medicine. It's in our roots and our DNA. It's in our founding documents. So some of the key people and moments for me have been talking to Nick Pizzicano early in my career, who was just such a believer in the discipline and in the role of family docs in making a difference to the patients, but in service to every member of the community. He felt that pretty strongly. I didn't invent this concept. It's been in our roots in the discipline all along. Another was the chair of the department here at Duke, Harvey Estes, and talking to him about how he got inspired to create a department whose core mission was to make a difference in the lives of individuals and families. That's why we're community and family medicine. I'm mixing a little bit people and events, but for me, one of the things that started to push my career was having one of the faculty members at Duke in the department killed in an anti-Ku Klux Klan rally while I was an intern. So the issue about social injustice is not just a theoretical issue. It was a very real live one. I was working in the ER the night he was shot by the Klan in a drive-by shooting. that and then work so that that was kind of that was very much inspirational. Working with the Durham community and learning how to make a difference in our community was certainly mattered, and all the partnerships there. But then two other pivotal events. One was on Duke's side when you it's now old history, but there was a moment when Duke decided that it was no longer going to do anything in primary care and would shut down the department, shut down the School of Nursing. That had never happened because the family physicians across the state and the country rose up and protested, and that decision was never implemented. So big institutions can make bad decisions. But then there's on the other side. We worked with the Durham community so much in making a difference in preventable illness that we dropped our teaching service, the family medicine teaching service. The Duke average daily census dropped to less than one because we're really good at taking care of people in the office. Now, we're incredibly busy in the office, but the result was we didn't admit much unless they were really sick. In which case, they're often on other group services, and we would round on them ourselves just to keep in touch. But I wanted to shift the residency to focusing more on keeping people out of the hospital than what to do once they're in the hospital. And that led to quite a bit of discussion with the RRC about whether this was really family medicine. And we got enough heat about that that we actually decided, I decided that I didn't believe in the model we were being required to train. I really thought we should be training family docs in what I thought family medicine had always been, which is about taking care of individuals and families and communities. So actually, we couldn't reach agreement about a model of family medicine that the RRC and we thought was appropriate. So we actually stopped taking new interns. I mean, that was a time when it's not just big academic institutions that can have problems. Sometimes big institutions can too. But there was a lot of leadership by the American Academy. The group decided to let us try continually as an experiment with decreased inpatient time, more time in the office and in the community. Some concern whether we'd have any interns, anybody applied to it. But this year we had over 600 applicants for five positions. In fact, the residents students have loved it. It's been highly successful. But what I got out of that goes back to Nick Pisacano, and that is being clear what you're trying to do, that family medicine is really has a social conscience and social mission. And sometimes your institutions need some help finding their way back to that core value.
Yeah, absolutely. So it sounds like you have some pretty strong feelings about the U.S. healthcare system in general. If you were put in charge, if you were the czar of the healthcare system, what would be the first thing you would change?
Well, it's as usual and not politically possible right now, but I would make primary care, basic primary care preventive services available to anyone in the country, regardless of ability to pay. That's just such a fundamental part of helping people be healthy and having healthy families and healthy communities, and we're far from it. We're getting that way. I still have hope, but we're such an outlier across around the world and not providing basic services to the people in need.
Yeah. Shifting more to some more personal things, do you have a talent that not many people know about?
Yeah, I love that question. I love sunlight and wind. It's part of the reason I love hiking. But the result is, and what very few people know this, is I build and restore and have a collection of outdoor mobiles. So things that spin in the wind of all sorts of different types and colors. And they just capture the light and add motion. Kind of reminder, even if I have to be inside, I can see the motion outside.
That's brilliant. If you could listen to only one music album for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Oh, that one stopped me dead in my tracks. My first answer, I'm going to give you two answers. The second one's the better one. The first answer is I actually studied music at Oberlin. So my first answer is I'd never completely analyzed the Brandenburg Concertos by Bach. And if I had to do only one album for the rest of my life, I'd probably do that one because you could go a long time studying that. Problem is I don't like them that much. So the true answer is that there's a jazz pianist that very few people know about named Margie Adams. And she has one solo unaccompanied piano album called Naked Keys that's just dynamic. First heard it, I think, when I was in college. We have several copies of it. It's what I carry when we go on trips to listen to. So it's just, it's unaccompanied piano jazz, and it's just fabulous.
Yeah. Very good. Do you have a favorite movie quote or other quote?
I do, and it probably won't surprise you. I have a t-shirt of it. I think my mom gave it to me, actually. And it's Margaret Mead. Never doubt the power of a small group to change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you so much, Lloyd. We really appreciate it.
This is Tanive Escamilla from Wayne State University School of Medicine. Please send us your thoughts by emailing us at afppodcast@aafp.org or tweeting at afppodcast. Send us ideas about family physicians we should interview or other things we should talk about. Our podcast team is Jake Anderson, Steve Brown, Sarah Coles, Megan Hunt, Kelsey Lewis, and Luke Peterson. Our sound and technical guru is Tyler Coles. Our theme song is written and recorded by Bill Dabbs and Ryan Evans. This podcast is brought to you by the residents and faculty of the University of Arizona College of Medicine Phoenix Family Medicine Residency. We'll talk to you soon for the next edition of the American Family Physician Podcast.